3 or 4 years ago, I think, as I started transitioning out of my conventional family practice in Garza County into more of an integrative functional medicine type of practice. Somewhere along the way, it may have been Dr. Dan Pompa introduced me, but somewhere along the way, I grabbed this book that Dr. Lipton wrote, The Biology of Belief, and it really fascinated me. Of course, we were all about nutrition and hydration and movement, but the fourth pillar at our clinic is peace and what the lack of peace can do to a person. And Dr. Lipton's book helped to really bridge that thought in my head with the reality and what the research is showing. So let me introduce real quick for our listeners who probably don't know Dr. Lipton, but he's a scientist and a lecturer. He received his PhD at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville. Also served as an associate professor of anatomy at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. He taught cell biology and histology and embryology, but did a lot of research also on the mechanisms that control cell behavior. He left the medical school to do independent research on this cell and the cell membrane and the interactions of the environment in the cell, and eventually made it back into medical school arena. It went to Stanford School of Medicine as a research fellow and continued his research in this field of cell biology and cell communication and the influence of the environment on the cell. So, Dr. Lipton, welcome to the show, and I hope I didn't botch that intro, but please feel free to add anything to that you want.
No, all I have to say is that I was a lucky guy to be in the right place at the right time to see something 50 years ago that is now today's leading edge of science, and so I was gifted with an opportunity to see and have some insights about cell biology that none of my colleagues were looking at, and partly because that was like 1967 or so when I was cloning stem cells. And
wow.
Today people say, oh yeah, stem cells, I know about stem cells. But in 1967, there were a handful of us in the entire world that even knew about stem cells. So I had the opportunity to work with them at that time. And the research was so profoundly altering of my life, because at the same time, as you mentioned, I was teaching in a medical school, and there's a curriculum. Mm-hmm. And in that curriculum, we were teaching something called genetic determinism, which the general public still has that concept in their mind.
Yes.
Genetic determinism is the belief that the genes you inherit will determine the character of your life. And that's what I was teaching in the laboratory. And I said, but what's the significance of that meaning behind this genetic determinism? And here's what it is. The idea is genes give us our characters, A. B, that we inherit the genes from our parents. C, we don't pick the genes. And D, if you don't like the genes that you've got, you can't change them. And then you put that in the perspective that genes were presumably turning on and off, controlling life. And I said, well, what is the collective significance of that? And the significance is, we were programming people to be victims, meaning, oh, I'm sorry, you got this genetic thing, it's not you, you can't do anything about it. And when people start to acquire that belief, they have a sense of being powerless.
Yeah.
My life is not under my control. These genes did this to me.
Right.
And so we were teaching victimization. You're a victim, victim of your heredity. And being a victim means it implies powerless.
Mm-hmm.
And it implies also that if you feel you're a victim, then by definition you need a rescuer.
Yeah.
Who's going to help me because I'm a victim and I can't handle my genes?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the pharmaceutical industry steps in and says, we are your friends and we are your helpers, and we're going to make all this chemistry and support you in spite of your bad genes. And so that's been the way of life. So if people have an issue and they look back and they go, oh, my God, it's in my family and I'm a victim and all that, that's the consequence of the belief in genetic determinism, which the public still has.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, that's not what science is entertaining these days. Science has a whole different perspective on it. A lot has to do with that research. I was a pioneer in this research on stem cells. And what I discovered back in my own research back then, there was no name for it at the time, but the science has since been named. The stuff that I was looking at as a pioneer, because nobody else was looking at it and nobody else was understanding it, and I was there going, oh my gosh, the results of these studies completely contradict the story I'm teaching medical students, and the new science, which now describes what I was observing. That science was coined in 1990. I was doing this work in 1967, but the new science is called epigenetics.
Yeah.
And what people need to know is this is a revolution. As much as there was a revolution when Newtonian physics was replaced by quantum physics, we went from dial telephones to cell phones. We made rocket ships and computers and, of course, atom bombs. That was the first thing they made with quantum physics. There was a revolution. It changed everything about the way we're living in our life right now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me say this. The revolution between genetics and epigenetics is equally profound and equally influencing the fate of human civilization for the simple reason. As mentioned, the conventional belief at the time was called genetic determinism. Genes turn on and off. Genes control your life and the character. Epigenetics, and it sounds like genetics, of course, is almost the same. And I go, but here's the difference, epi. Epi means above. So the old science, genetic control, meant control by genes. Yes, cancer is under genetic control. It's caused by genes. That's the belief. I say, well, what is epigenetics? Well, epi means above. So when I say epigenetic control, it means literally control above the genes. And all of a sudden you say, what do you mean? There's something else that controls the genes, not the genes? And I go, this is the profound revolution, is that our consciousness, our lifestyle, our environment are the factors that control our genetic expression.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, well, okay, that's pretty neat. And I go, no, you see, here's what the difference is. If genes control you and you don't control the genes, then you're a victim because you can't do anything about it. But if genes are controlled by environment, lifestyle, nutrition, consciousness, I say, oh, my God, I can influence every one of those. And I go, precisely. The new history study science of heredity is that, no, we are not victims of our genes. In fact, here's a factual number that's very important for people to grab, and that is this. Less than 1% of disease is actually connected to genetics. Less than 1%, you can say, oh, the genes created this problem. And I go, well, geez, 90-plus percent of disease has nothing to do with that. And now guess what? 90% of disease is due to lifestyle, nutrition, consciousness, environment. And I go, is exactly what the new science of epigenetics has been saying. And I say, and the total bottom line wonderful character is this. Every one of those things, environment, consciousness, nutrition, et cetera, are things that we can control.
Mm-hmm.
And because we can control them, that means then we are the masters of our biology and health, not the victims of our genes.
Right.
And this changes the entire game because I'm not a victim, I'm a master. It says if it's not working right, there are things that, A, I've done probably that interfered with the system, and more importantly, there are things that I can do to bring the health back to the system. So all of a sudden, I am empowered with my own health. In other words, I am controlling this. And if people understand this and then look at their illnesses, because there's a healthcare crisis on the entire planet,
mm-hmm.
And then turn around and say, listen, less than 1% of all that has anything to do with genetics. And all of a sudden it says, then why do we have a healthcare crisis? And the answer is because we have not been given an awareness of how our biology works.
Yeah.
There's a standard saying everyone's familiar with, knowledge is power. I go, that's absolutely true. But I want to say the corollary because it's also absolutely true, and that is a lack of knowledge is a lack of power. And therefore, being deprived of the knowledge that we are influencing our own genetics and our own health through the way we're experiencing the planet, if you don't have that information, then you become powerless, and that's why the healthcare crisis exists today, because everyone thinks, it's not me, it's my genes. Yeah. And I go, no, we have to take that back, Ben. So yeah. That's really the foundation that got me off into a different world, because my research was completely antagonistic to the conventional story given to medical students, which then is passed on to, of course, the patients and the community. And let me just close this with this very important point, because people use it all the time, and it's completely wrong. And that is, people talk about genes turn on and genes turn off. And this gives a belief to what? That these chemicals inside my cells are managing the life of the cell. The genes are managing all this, mm-hmm. and that they're turning on and off. And they do this, you know, like you could be walking down the street and all of a sudden a cancer gene turns on and then you find yourself with cancer. And let me correct this, because this is one of the biggest blatant falsehoods that ever existed, and that is this. Genes cannot regulate their own activity. Genes do not turn on and genes do not turn off. Genes have zero control over what's going to be expressed in your biology. What's being in control is your consciousness and your environment. And the relevance about that, as I mentioned, is, well, you can change your consciousness and you can change your environment, and as a result, there's nothing that you can't heal yourself from. And we must let go of the total falsehood that genes are controlling us, because the new science of epigenetics is we control our genes. Sorry, I ran off on that, Ben, a little bit, but no. I hope that was useful.
Very useful, very, very beneficial. I give presentations to the general public all the time, and it seems like I have to spend most of my lecture time trying to just convince people of that mindset of the victim mentality, genes control me, I don't have any control over any of this or any say over my own life, basically, from a health perspective. And it's so disheartening for me that knowing the public still thinks this, but the science has been around for so long now. I was looking back at in your book, I think 2005 is when it was published, and you're talking about you doing research in the 1960s. And I forgot when Watson and Crick discovered that double helix, but I just Googled
53.
It. Yeah, 1953.
Interesting history is biology, science didn't even know what the hereditary material was until 1944. That's when they said, oh, DNA is involved with controlling the proteins, and the proteins give us the character of our lives. The proteins, the molecules called proteins, about 100,000 different versions of proteins in the human body, they're building blocks. They assemble and create our biology. Now, I say, why is it relevant? I say, well, the genes are blueprints to make these proteins. Mm-hmm. And so we, in looking at the control of life, then they said, oh, well, the proteins, whether they're healthy or not healthy, provide the character of our biology. And then all of a sudden they say, yeah, but the genes are the programmers of these things. And then everybody started focusing on the genes. 1953, it was, 9 years after DNA was identified as the hereditary material. Watson and Crick, those are the two names that most people are familiar with. And now that I have a platform for a second, I would like to correct that vision, because the real star behind the understanding of DNA double helix was a woman called Rosalind Franklin. And people go, who? I go, well, here's the interesting story, that Rosalind Franklin was the one who discovered the DNA double helix in her crystallography work with the nucleic acids. And her major advisor gave away her research results to Watson and Crick, and she didn't even know it. And as a consequence, they studied her stuff and published this, the DNA double helix story in 1953, and she didn't have any idea that they had taken her stuff and did that. So I want to say that discovery of DNA in 1953 was primarily Rosalind Franklin, followed by Watson and Crick.
Wow.
I'd like to set that straight, because today's revolution of, look, recognizing the role of women in our world, and science has been an old boys club for the longest time, and that's why her major advisor had no feelings about, oh, let me just give away her research, and it's like, for me, it's like, what a crime because nobody really knows who she was, and she is actually the one that discovered the DNA double helix.
And what was her name one more time, Dr. Lipton?
Rosalind Franklin.
Rosalind Franklin. And, well, you're right. I didn't know that.
I think she, you know, posthumously she was given recognition, but the public has no idea who she is.
Yeah.
And everyone goes, Watson and Crick. I go, well, they actually stole it from Rosalind Franklin.
Well, thank you for setting the record straight for Mrs. Franklin. But what amazes me is that was 1953, and then fast forward 12 years, 1965, did you say, when you started looking
60,
at
67, really.
67.
So that's when my cloning studies on stem cells were revealing that genes did not control biology.
Tell us about that.
That's when, and of course, by then, all of my colleagues and the world of science in general were like lemmings following this DNA story and going off the cliff. And I was on the sideline going, I don't think it's the DNA. And they looked at me like, well, you're the weird one. Everyone else is following the gene. You're the only one that's not. And so basically they just looked at the numbers and sort of like voted, was I right or wrong based on how many people were listening to what I was talking about and how many people were following genes. I was like, okay, I'm the weird one. But in 30 years, a little less than about 25 years later, what I was observing had become now an official science called epigenetics. So there was a number of years it was very difficult for me to try to get people to understand the meaning of my research, because they had a complete concrete vision already of this is genetics, this is Watson and Crick, and this is the way it works, and these genes turn on and off. And it's like, oh my God, it was very hard to try to change the direction of that weather vane, because it was so blowing toward DNA that anything other than a DNA story was sort of like left in the dirt. And
right.
I persisted, fortunately, and 25 years later, gratified to find that I was absolutely right. And what was really much more wonderful is, because over that 25 years, not giving up on that idea, but pursuing what this research meant, was what ultimately led to the book, as you mentioned, The Biology of Belief, which really is the exact understanding
right.
about how powerful we are and how we have no awareness of this, and as a result, we have become victims, even though we are the most powerful creators of our own biology.
Well, I certainly wish it was being taught more widespread in medical schools and elsewhere, but I think...
Let me add this, Ben, for a second, just only because there has been a push against this for the longest time, and it was coming from the pharmaceutical industry. And
hard
the reason
to believe.
Is very simply this. If you can blame illness on a biochemical breakdown, genes and proteins being messed up, then you can legitimately sell, oh, here's a chemical to fix your genes and your biochemistry. And the issue was, the problem wasn't down at the mechanics of the chemistry. The problem was with the origin of the consciousness that was telling the cells what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we keep trying to fix underneath with drugs and chemistry when it was actually consciousness that needed to be affected, not the physical chemistry. The pharmaceutical companies, of course, can't sell consciousness. They can't sell energy. And as a result, they have an active push against this biology for a simple reason. If you can heal yourself, which you can, through consciousness and taking care of your health with nutrition and environment, then nobody would buy drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you say, oh, well, there's a problem. The drug industry is one of the biggest industries on the planet with multi-trillion dollars worth of money. And what if they do it like on TV every 15 minutes? They're still trying to sell you, you're broken, here's a drug. Here you're
mm-hmm.
broken, here's a drug.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is, if they could sell energy medicine in a capsule or a tablet, then the pharmaceutical company would be talking about everything I'm talking about today.
Yep.
But the simple reality is, that's not possible. And so the pharmaceutical company uses its massive amount of money and its powerful influence to keep the public somewhat naive about the fact that you don't need pharmaceutical drugs. You just need to change consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you and I, Ben, have an issue when we try to talk to the public and find most of them have no idea what the heck we're talking about.
Right. Yeah, and I never really understood or believed that. It was hard for me to believe. I've come from a long line of physicians and went to UT Houston Medical School and came out of there just rip-roaring, ready to go save the world. And the only tool I had in my toolbox at that time were pharmaceuticals because that's all I was taught in school. And I just automatically assumed that that's all there was, because if there was something else, then my great professors at UT Houston would have taught me this something else. So therefore, there is nothing else. Or, you know, that's the mindset coming out. We're just so narrow-minded because we're trained narrow-mindedly, but with good intention. I went out trying to help people, but I just didn't know there was more to it. And slowly I began to learn.
Funny, you know, if you had to go to medical school again today, Ben, I don't think you would like it at all. It is such a regimentation. You know, when I was teaching medical school, as you mentioned, when I was teaching the first year, first semester, so I would see all the fresh students coming in. And when you see them coming in, they're like glowing with hope and love, and it's like, oh, I'm going to be a doctor and I'm going to help the world. And the interesting thing is, knowing them, of course, from the day they came into school and knowing them until the last year of school, fourth year of school, and then the fourth year I'd talk to them and they'd all say, get me out of this place.
Yeah.
And they were so discouraged because the programming has taken away power from them. You know, when family physicians were the main type of healing, mm-hmm. where doctors were just mainly, you know, family physicians,
right.
That was when medicine had the greatest amount of healing in its endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was because the family physician in those days knew the individuals in the family, knew the dynamics, knew the character and life of those people. And when offering help and assistance, those factors were taken into any diagnosis of what the family dynamics were and all that other kind of stuff,
yeah.
as an understanding of whatever illness was presented, and they even prescribed placebos quite a lot because they also knew it was consciousness. And family physicians were great healers. But then the age of specialization, and all of a sudden, oh, we have a cardiologist, and we have a gastrointestinal medical doctor, and we have a neurologist. And what did we find? That the more specific the area that they studied, the less effective they were in overall health.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the problem today. And in fact, doctors are given so little room to work. They're, most of them, because of the corporate demand.
Yeah.
Get to see patients about like 15 minutes, and that's, okay, next.
Yeah.
As you said, they're also programmed to prescribe the drugs. Even,
right.
You know, for interesting point is, if a person comes in with a viral cold, the standard operating procedure is to prescribe an antibiotic.
Right.
And yet the problem is, and everyone knows it in that field, antibiotics don't handle viruses. And so why are you giving antibiotics? And the answer is, there's such a concern over being sued,
yeah.
The litigious nature of our society, that there's a standard practice. And the standard practice is you do something that's accepted as a standard practice, and therefore you are safe from law. So they give antibiotics, knowing that the antibiotics are not going to affect the virus that causes the cold, but they give it because they know that they're following standard operating procedure, and despite the fact that they're not going to help, that's not going to help the cold, they did what was called for. And that's, again, an unfortunate situation because we have become so litigious, and medicine has been broken, and medicine today still does absolute miracles with trauma.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm in a car accident and I'm busted up, bones are, you know, cut open and stuff like that, I'm not calling a chiropractor. I'm not calling a homeopath. I'm not calling a naturopath doctor. I'm going to call a medical doctor.
Yeah.
Why? They do miracles. But then if you turn around and go, well, how about cancer? diabetes, Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease. I go, they're not that successful.
Right.
And they're not that successful because the training they get is not really fulfilling the new understanding about how environment controls genes and genes do not shape the world that we live in. And so the medical profession is being held back and their fear of being sued and follow the procedure. They're bound. I feel very badly because I saw these students come in with such great enthusiasm about being a medical student. And see them, we drop them off in the street, and it's just, I feel very badly about that because they're not equipped or educated to deal with what we now know in regard to how biology works.
Yeah, I was visiting with a local physician who was really well-regarded in this community, well-loved, well-liked by everybody. And he left his family practice position because he was basically burnt out, and he went and moved to Colorado, worked some stuff up there, and he's since moved back. But he's working in the ER, shift work, and he told me, I will never go back to primary care chronic disease management because two reasons. Number one, my average visit's about 7 minutes. I have to just crank through them like cattle. Number two, no one gets better. I keep giving these pills out and no one's getting well. So, I mean, there even doctors, seasoned doctors, are so frustrated with the system from a busyness standpoint and from the standpoint of no one's really getting well. Our outcomes are so bad. I mean, it is sad. We take the brightest minds.
It's very interesting, Ben, because I, having been a teacher in the medical school and knowing my students who have gone on, the actual number who actually only prefer to work in emergency room is a growing number, and partly because they say, okay, I can deal with this trauma stuff right here. I leave the long-term stuff to somebody else because they've already experienced that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really work, and it's frustrating.
Yep.
It's frustrating to be a doctor and not be able to help somebody, and especially because, as we now know, the training is not adequate.
Yeah.
It's not adequate because it's not understanding the new front edge, which is, oh, my God, it's a revolution in healthcare. Just waiting to manifest as people pull out of conventional care and look for alternative healing.
Yeah, and it's happening left and right. Unfortunately, mostly the people that come to our clinic is because they're suffering so much. They've been in the conventional world. It's the results are awful, and they're basically about to die before. But that opens their mind. They get on the internet. They read. They listen to other testimonials from our clinic, and then they decide to make the jump into a different. I was just telling a patient this morning. It's all about your toolbox. And in medical school, we're taught some things, but it's a pretty narrow toolbox. And simply, we've got a bigger toolbox now that we've learned this other stuff. The stuff is the epigenetics. But the beauty of it is the epigenetics, like you talked about at the top of the show, boils down to we got to turn this thing back around. Quit looking at the doctor for the answer. We're going to put the mirror on you and say, you're the answer. In fact, the name of my radio show is You're the Cure. Because this is all about, hey, you, the patient, have to take responsibility, get educated, take responsibility, make these changes, and then let your body start functioning the way it was intended to. When you give it all it needs and avoid what it doesn't need, it'll function. So it's a totally different way of looking at things.
And as you're aware and as I'm aware, being in the field of the research on that, this has been the primary direction for bringing health back to the planet, where people are starting to recognize I'm involved with my own health.
Yeah.
I am doing something. Therefore, instead of waiting for somebody else to fix me, I can start right here by taking care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as I said, that's not in the interest of the pharmaceutical company for you to heal yourself. That's clearly what the problem is right there.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, we don't take insurance at our clinic, and that's another big mindset people have to jump over. You know, the stuff that your copay is going to cover is the stuff that's going to keep you sick and not get you well. So that's part of the personal responsibility, too, is recognizing you're going to have to pay for it, but you're either going to pay now or pay later. Work, you know, missed days at work and just sickness and suffering and all that in general, all your medication costs and all that. But that's another talk, the economics of this. I want to go back to 1967 explain, I've read the book but and listened to other interviews, but explain to our listeners, what was it that got you out of the Watson and Crick and gene thought into this epigenetic thought so many years ago, 50 years ago now? What, describe those experiments early on.
Yeah, and as I said, I was teaching in the medical curriculum, the conventional curriculum, about how genes control life. And so that's what I'm teaching in the laboratory, in the classroom. And then in my laboratory, I was cloning stem cells. Let me explain what that means. First of all, everyone out there who is listening to this has stem cells, regardless of what they might read about, only because if you're still alive, then by definition you have stem cells. The reason is simple. While we look in the mirror and see ourselves as a single living organism, a human body, that's an illusion, the concept of a single organism, because the simple truth is we are made out of 50 trillion cells. The cells are the living entity. The community of cells, which I give a name to, Bruce, you give a name, Ben, that's a community. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, we're not a single entity, we're a community of cells, 50 trillion. And then I said, and what about that? And I said, well, cells have a normal lifespan, like the entire lining of the digestive tract, how many feet that is, 20-something feet or more, the lining of that digestive tract is replaced every 3 days. Now, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of billions of cells which are dying every 3 days. And I say, well, the only way you can stay alive, of course, is to replace the hundreds and billions of cells. Yeah. And this is where stem cells come in. As I said, stem cells are embryonic cells. So the moment before someone's born, I do a tissue biopsy and I point to a cell. I say, oh, look, there's an embryonic cell. And I say, wait a minute after the baby is born, do the same biopsy, look at the same cell. And now I say, oh, there's a stem cell. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just because once you're born, can't call it an embryonic cell, and yet functionally it is. So I'm taking a stem cell, a functional embryonic cell. It's multipotential. It could become anything. I put one cell in a petri dish. This is what cloning is all about. I just put one cell in a dish, and every 10 hours that cell divides. So first is one, then it doubles two, then it doubles four, doubles eight, and keeps doubling and doubling. And after a week, I have 30,000 cells in the petri dish. The important point is that all cells came from one parent. The result, why it's important, is that meant 30,000 genetically identical cells. They all have the exact same genes. Mm-hmm. And I go, now what? Well, and this is the connection, Ben, so that this is, when we get this, like, oh, my God. And the connection is this. When you grow cells in a culture dish, we grow them in a fluid called culture medium. Cells are like fish. They have to live in a fluid. So when you cut yourself open, fluid leaks out because underneath your skin, it's like a giant aquarium with 50 trillion cells in it. And I say, well, what is the fluid you grow cells in? And I go, the equivalent of blood. So if I'm going to grow human cells, I look at the composition of human blood, and in the laboratory I synthesize a version of that, and we call it culture medium. So culture medium is the equivalent, the functional equivalent of blood. Okay, now I put in a single cell. 1 week later, 30,000 genetically identical cells. I split them into three petri dishes, so each dish has genetically identical cells in it. But what I did, because I make the culture medium, I can alter some of the composition, the chemistry. Mm-hmm. So I changed the chemistry slightly in each for each of the three dishes. So they're all fed culture medium, but with slightly different chemistry. In dish one, with culture medium one, the cells form muscle. In dish two, with a different version, culture medium two, the cells form bone. And in dish three, with, again, a different culture medium, the cells form fat cells. And now you have to stand back and go, what controls the fate of the cells? Why should one set become bone, one set muscle, one set fat? What controlled that? And you say, well, the genes. I go, no, they all had the same genes. The answer, the environment.
Yeah.
The chemistry of a culture medium
yeah.
is determining which genes are going to be read. Change the chemistry of the culture medium, and you change the genetic and behavioral character of the cells. So I go, oh, wow, that's an interesting laboratory experiment. It reveals, of course, that genes did not control this at all. It was the environment in which the cells lived that controlled the genetics. And then you go, well, that's a neat story about cells in a plastic petri dish. And then I go, now, wait, let's back up a second. I said that a human is actually 50 trillion cells under the skin. I go, oh, we are skin-covered petri dishes with 50 trillion cells under there.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, and we have the original culture medium, blood. And I say, it doesn't. This is the critical part. It doesn't make a difference if the cell is in a plastic dish or in your skin-covered dish. The cell is controlled by the composition of the culture medium. In the plastic dish, the one I created in the lab, but in your skin-covered dish, your blood. And all of a sudden, I said, well, wait, my blood circulating through my body is adjusting my genetics. I go, absolutely. And I go, well, then there's information in the blood. I go, yeah, because all we talk about in blood is nutrition, oxygen, amino acids, sugars, fats, the elements for nutrition. I go, yeah, but blood is filled with very important organizing chemicals such as emotional chemistry, such as the neurohormones and neuropeptides that regulate the functions of our system. The secretions of our brain are creating the composition of the culture medium. Give us a simple example. If you are just sitting there and your eyes are closed, and then you open your eyes and you see someone you love, the picture of love in your mind is translated by your brain into chemistry that complements love. So in other words, if you open your eyes and see someone you love, there's a moment of pleasure. Well, that's because the brain releases dopamine, which is a pleasure chemical when you see someone you love.
Mm-hmm.
You bond with that one you love. There's a biological bonding. And I go, oh, that's because when you're in love like that, you release oxytocin, which is a bonding chemical. That you and your partner become more infatuated with each other and you become more attractive to each other. That's a consequence of a chemical released when you're in love called vasopressin. And one of the important chemicals released in love is called growth hormone, which obviously that's the name and you know what it does. I say, why is it relevant? If you make chemistry of your blood based using those chemicals as signals, dopamine, vasopressin, oxytocin, growth hormone, the result is you're encouraging and nourishing yourself, and guess what? People observe that. They say, oh, look, see how they glow. See how they're so in love. They're so in love. They're so healthy. I go, that is the consequence of love chemistry in your culture medium called blood being distributed to 50 trillion cells.
Mm-hmm.
I go, just now to look at an opposite consequence, I say, this time your eyes are closed, but when you open them, you see something that scares you. I go, oh, well, you're not releasing love chemistry. Right away, that chemistry is not going to be released. I say, then what chemistry is being released? I say, oh, stress hormones, cortisol, inflammatory agents, things like histamine. These are regulating and getting us ready for a protection response, fight or flight. This is different than love. And I go, yeah, but where's the difference? I say, the chemistry from the brain is changing the culture medium, which now has been demonstrated to control behavior and genetics. And then to tie the last piece together is, as I mentioned, the brain is adding the chemistry to the blood, the culture medium, which in turn controls the fate of the cells. And then I said, but the chemistry released by the brain is not an accident or a coincidence. It is a complement to the image we hold in our mind. So I said, when I was holding the image of love, oh, I released the love chemistry, the dopamine, the growth hormone, et cetera. But when the image in my mind was fear, I didn't release those chemicals. I released stress hormones. And all of a sudden I go, wow, the picture in your mind is translated by the brain into complementary chemistry. There's a chemistry of love, there's a chemistry of fear, there's a chemistry of anger, there's a chemistry of hate. Each of these kinds of emotional characteristics are chemistry released by the brain that coordinates your body to respond to that. Mm-hmm. So if you change what you see in your mind, you change your perception of your mind, then what you're doing is changing the chemistry to coordinate with the image in your mind. And you go, well, that sounds so new agey. And I go, no, wait. For nearly 100 years, we're very familiar with something called the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, what is the placebo effect? I say, well, you have an illness. Your physician comes up and says, here is the greatest, newest drug that's going to, you know, revolutionize it. It's going to heal you. And you believe this because you've got, oh, my God, I've been waiting for this drug. Now that I could get this drug, I'm gonna get better. And you take the drug, you get better, and then you find out it was a sugar pill.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the placebo effect. I say, well, what healed you? Well, obviously not the sugar pill.
Yeah.
What healed you was the vision, the picture in your mind of this is health. I'm going to be healthy. And I say, well, why is that relevant? Because health is related to chemistry that is in harmony with health. So a vision of health releases chemistry that brings health to the system. And I say, and that's why it was the chemistry that resulted from your mind in placebo, not the sugar pill.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone goes, yeah, positive thinking is the foundation of placebo effect, which is actually responsible for one-third of all drug healings, which is a very important number. One-third of all drug healings are directly due to the placebo effect, not the drug.
Yeah, I think I read in your book 50%.
Why is it relevant? And the answer was this. It said your thought controlled your health, not the drug.
Yeah.
And then we say, well, that's positive thinking that led to the placebo effect. Now, this to me is the piece that was left out, and this is the more important piece, and that is this. Is it only positive thinking that influences our health? I go, no. Negative thinking influences it as well,
mm-hmm.
but in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a positive thought can heal you because your belief in the healing, but a negative thought can cause any disease on this planet. It can kill you. A fear, you can be so afraid of something, you could die just from the fear. The chemistry of fear can kill you. And I go, oh, my God, you mean negative thinking has an impact on my health? I said, every much as powerful as positive thinking, but the results are in the opposite direction. Placebo thinking, positive thinking, can heal you of any disease. Excuse me. And negative thinking, referred to as nocebo, can cause any disease. So, for example, only 1% of diseases connected to genetics. I say, where's the rest of the disease coming from? I go, environment and consciousness. And I say, why is it relevant? Because we're living in fear, we're living in angst, we're living in fight or flight, and those chemicals of that kind of consciousness undermine health. And if you sustain that kind of fear, it will kill you. It will give you any disease. Everyone used to say genes cause cancer. Here's a fact. This is a fact. There is no gene that causes cancer. Everyone goes, oh, what about cancer genes? I say, they're associated with cancer, but they didn't cause it. Give you an example. Most women are afraid to have a diagnosis. They have the BRCA1 gene, the breast cancer gene.
Mm-hmm.
Angelina Jolie, she had that gene, and her mother died of breast cancer, and her grandmother died of breast cancer. So young Angelina decided that a double mastectomy is going to save her life. So if she cuts off her breast before the cancer starts, she's going to be healthy. And I go, does the BRCA1 gene cause cancer? And here's the answer. 50% of the women that carry that gene never get cancer. And I have to stop right there and say, having the gene does not mean getting the cancer. It's a lifestyle that will engage that gene mm-hmm. that will cause the cancer.
Yeah.
And that's why spontaneous remissions of cancer can occur, because when a person changes their belief system or change the character of their environment, they can recover their health. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, you can recover from cancer. And if people out there are not familiar with a book by a dear friend of mine. Her name is Anita Moorjani, and her book is Dying to Be Me. And I just love Anita, and she's, for me, the poster child of the biology of belief for a very simple reason. She had cancer for years. I think it was a 10-year bout. She had an oncologist. They were doing tests. She was full out in cancer. And in the last week of her life, her system shut down. She was on support, life support, machines. And a few days after she got on life support, she went into a coma. And her doctor called her family and said, oh, my goodness, Anita is in a coma. And as an oncologist, I have to let you know that when my patients are in a coma at this stage, that's the end, and you should show up because she doesn't have long to live. Anita, in that coma, had an out-of-body experience. I'm not going to go into that right now. There's a biology behind it, but right now she had an out-of-body experience and communicated with her father where she thought that she lost the love of her father because she was in an arranged marriage and then pulled out a couple of days before the marriage, and the whole family was in shame, and her father, and that's what provoked the cancer. Mm. And the result was that shame that she lived with, the chemistry of the shame in her blood led to the cancer, and when she was in that out-of-body coma, she had a communication with her father and resolved that her father was not mad at her and her father loved her and all that stuff. And what was the point? She resolved the conflict, the psychological conflict that was creating the chemistry that supported the cancer. She woke up out of this coma, and guess what? The first thing was she didn't even need the life support anymore. She woke up, and all of a sudden her system was working. And she was at that point so emaciated that lumps of cancer were sticking through her skin. You could see the cancer. And within 2 weeks, the lumps were gone, and within 4 weeks, there was no cancer in her body.
Wow.
And she's the poster child for biology belief. For what reason? She took it all the way to the end. She was in the coma at the end of her life and had a change in consciousness. And when she woke up from that change in consciousness, the cancer immediately began to disappear, and her body came back, and she's the most wonderful, happy human today, and I cite her as biology of belief poster child, because here she was on death's door, I mean hours away from death, and a simple change of belief brought her back to life and eliminated the cancer. She has no cancer.
That's an amazing story.
I give that as a hope. Because a lot of people say, they just get diagnosed with cancer, and where's their consciousness? Oh, my God, I'm going to get sick. I'm going to get diagnosed. You're sending a picture of what? What picture is that consciousness going to provoke in your blood? Mm-hmm. It's going to provoke the symptoms of that disease. So, in other words, if you can be convinced that you have cancer, you will create the chemistry that will create cancer.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, my God. And it turns out there's less than 10% of connection in heredity at all for cancer. Cancer is just lifetime consequence of not living in harmony with your world, usually with suppressed anger. And people need to know this, because in the genetic story, oh, you got the cancer, you got the gene, you're going to die. And it's like, that's a hopeless story.
Mm-hmm.
And with the epigenetic story was, oh, no, change the chemistry. I said, how do you change the chemistry? Well, the mind is the source of the chemistry that the brain is going to release based on the picture.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, we change the picture in our mind, and we change our genetics and our behavior, and we can go from death back to full life just like Anita did.
That's amazing.
And she's not a genetic weirdo, and it was not a miracle. It was an understanding of biology.
Right.
And if the public knew this, then instead of having that immediate fear, which is the gut reaction when a diagnosis of cancer is told to a patient, of course there's no love chemistry coming out when that diagnosis is given. The chemistry that comes out is victim, hopeless.
Yep.
And I say, well, that chemistry is obviously not going to provide for health at all. And then so, Ben, I really just want to thank you for letting me say all these things because I really want people to understand it's your belief.
Yeah.
And if you believe that you are going to get cancer, you can have a cancer. If you believe you can heal yourself of cancer, you can heal yourself of cancer. The simplest definition to explain this is a quote from Henry Ford, the founder of Ford Motor Company. Henry Ford said, whether you believe you can or whether you believe you can't, you're right. And that's
wow.
It. That's the bottom yeah. line. Is, well, can you heal yourself or can't you heal yourself? Oh, it depends on what you believe right there.
Yeah.
And that's why we need to give people this information. We need to give them that knowledge because that knowledge is where the power is.
Mm-hmm.
Without this knowledge of epigenetics, there is no power that we have in our biology.
Right.
And with epigenetics, we, as I mentioned, are the masters of our biology.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for that, Ben.
Oh, well, thank you. That's been a fascinating run of information. We're about out of time, but I want to summarize and then get your final thought on this. I mean, obviously, there's things in our environment that are going to affect these genes, or let them be red or not red. You know, nutrition, toxins, you know, a good, clean hydration, these different things. But those are all physical, you know, nutrients, physical things. And I know you would probably say, yeah, all that's important, but it's almost like Newtonian to quantum. You got to, beyond these physical particles, these thoughts that we have about ourselves, like the
yeah.
example you just
yeah.
gave, she thought her daddy didn't love her because she got out of that arranged marriage, but the truth was he did love her. But the thought in her head wasn't based in the truth. It was based in a lie, basically, is how I put it with my patients. So we've got to drill down. Number one, you got to believe that epigenetics is where it's at. So we got to teach you that first. But then number two, we got to get in there and try to identify which emotion, anger, fear, whatever. It seems like fear is a huge one. But then, okay, we've identified that emotion. Now let's identify the thought that's leading to that. And what about that thought's not accurate, not true? And then what is the truth?
Yes.
It boils right down to that
yes.
very core thing of there's a false belief you have or a lie, I call it, and then there's a truth. But then that seems to me, and I don't know, I've never heard you speak on your personal belief system, and you may not care to, and that's fine. But where I go with it is this is a spiritual thing. I mean, if you're getting down to a truth,
100%, Ben.
A truth
100%.
And a lie, then you got to bring the truth to that lie. So you're stepping over into this realm, people would say, is not being a doctor anymore. You're being a preacher, which I'm not into religion necessarily. Spiritual
I'm,
stuff
I'm
and
religion
are two different things.
I'm not in religion either.
Right.
I am 100% into spirit, but that's quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
And let me add this because I know we're running out of time, but I want to add this. Quantum physics is the most valid science on planet Earth. There is no science more truthful than quantum physics. That's the first premise, number
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
Premise number two, then, is the first belief in quantum physics is the world that we're experiencing right now is an illusion of our consciousness. That was from 1925.
Wow.
And that's where the weirdness of quantum physics comes in, because it's really how you look at the world that determines what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You change how you see the world, you change your life experiences. And so while epigenetics is saying that consciousness is creating the genetics and the behavior, quantum physics, even more base than biology, acknowledges that the whole thing that we're experiencing is consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really cool that physics, quantum physics, and epigenetics are telling the exact same story.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a quote. Let me give this quote. It's a very simple quote. The energy, we're immersed in an energy field like an aquarium right now. Wherever you're sitting, there's radio waves, cell phone waves, television broadcasts, solar energy information. It's all energy floating around. We're in an aquarium of energy called the field. That's what quantum physics calls the energy that's surrounding us. And here's the phrase from Albert Einstein, and he's the master. And in the briefest, shortest words, he said this, the field, the energy around us, is the sole governing agency of the particle, matter. The invisible energy is the sole governing agency of matter. Field is the energy. And I go, what's the definition of field? I said, invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. Mm. I go, oh, my God, that's the same definition as spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. So quantum physics is giving us the scientific foundation for what was called spirit, an invisible energy. But quantum physics says not only is there this invisible energy, which is called the field, but the field is the primary shaper of the material world, which is the same thing that spirit was talking about.
Yeah.
And so there's a convergence at this current time. And so your work with spirit, field, if people don't want to, they because religion has co-opted the concept of spirit, and as you mentioned, and I agree with 100%, separate religion from spirit. Mm-hmm. Spirit is the energy. Spirit is the field. The field is controlling matter. And so that our spiritual essence of who we are, why we're here, why we came here, is shaping not just our biology and physiology, is shaping our life experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the invisible consciousness, which in quantum physics is the overriding control. And so what you were saying about spirit, I just wanted to emphasize, Ben, this is completely the foundation of quantum physics.
Right.
And the exact thing they were saying, and so therefore, it's not a new agey idea, but it's hard science that the invisible field, or spirit, you say which one, either one, is what is ultimately shaping our biology. We change our consciousness, and the biology will change right after we do that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it makes it almost laughable that we think we can throw a man-made pharmaceutical chemical agent into this amazing body and have some benefit from it.
The complexity of the system is so great that our little bit of knowledge, I remember there's an old phrase, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Right.
The restricted amount of knowledge that science holds about the connections of the cells and their communication and all that, the little bit of knowledge they have that led them to do pharmaceutical drugs is unfortunately has become a very dangerous thing. 300,000 Americans die every year from prescription drugs.
Mm.
And I forgot what the number is, but it was maybe 30,000 people die from illegal drugs. And we have this great war on illegal drugs, and 10 times as many people are dying from prescription drugs.
Yeah.
But that's called, oh, the cost of doing medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's too darn much of a cost.
Yeah.
300,000 people are dying from taking pharmaceutical drugs.
Agreed. I tell people all the time in my lectures, if there were only two options, suffer or take a drug, you might consider it. You still want to weigh the risk and benefit. But there's this third option, fix it, which really it's let the body fix itself, but it's rooted in all this epigenetic stuff. So thank you very, very much, Dr. Lipton, for coming on and joining us today and helping to solidify and bring the science into and the spiritual really all into focus for us and help, because that's the biggest hurdle I think your regular old West Texans and Eastern New Mexico folk have to do is jump that hurdle of what? There's more stuff out there besides genetics. So you've totally helped them not only jump that hurdle, but just smash it to smithereens.
Well,
so thank you.
I want to thank you, because obviously I'm on your program right now and you've opened up the airwaves for information. And the knowledge you offer, remember, is knowledge is power. So I really want to thank you for creating a platform to offer the public this valuable knowledge so they can empower their lives. And I want to thank you for letting me contribute to your mission, because that's where evolution is going to come from, people that are going to take their power back.
Right. Amen, brother. Well, The Biology of Belief, this is Dr. Bruce Lipton's book. I'd recommend everybody get online and get a copy of it and read it. Some fascinating stuff. And just share this interview. It'll be archived on our website and on iTunes, so share it with your friends. So thank you again, Dr. Lipton, and we'll have to have you back someday.